This is Car Expert.
The cheapest Ranger, when it launches in 2022, will have a bigger, better screen than the most expensive Ranger Raptor or Wildtrak in 2021.
It's not really about the MC20 in a sense. What it really is about Maserati's return to form.
This car is so addictive and intoxicating, and you just want to sell your house. You'll live under a bridge if you can have a GT3.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Mike Costello.
Hey, Mandy.
And hello, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mike and Mandy.
We're going to do a bit of a Toyota chat in the intro. Scully, you've been driving the Land Cruiser, so we'll have a little bit of a chat about that as well. But, Marco, tell us about the Toyota Product Center.
Yeah, so Toyota's old Altona manufacturing plant, where it made Camrys and Orions and Corollas for decades, has been converted into a massive centre of excellence, which has got a test track and a training facility and a parts hub. But as of this week, it's also got a new $40 million product centre, which basically under one roof, and that roof being the refurbished old engine plant, now hosts Toyota's design studio that does work both for local product and international product, particularly in the Asia Pacific region, the engineering team that works on the global Hilux and Land Cruiser programs and Prado programs, the accessory development team that makes and develops Toyota genuine accessory parts, and also an assembly line for the Hilux, Rugged X and Rogue, the special local editions. So big investment is happening there. It's obviously not what it was when it was making cars, but it is nice to see that Toyota at least maintains some involvement in the Altona area with that site, and it's always good to see new things happening there. And that's alongside the hydrogen center that it's got there and all sorts of other cool things too. So a nice local news story.
Fantastic. Awesome to hear. So your time behind the wheel of a Land Cruiser, Scully, how was that?
So it's ongoing, which is exciting because we've written a lot and read a lot and talked a lot about the new Land Cruiser, but getting behind the wheel of one's really hard. Toyota doesn't have many in the country. And, of course, the first one that came in went straight off with Paul to film and then disappeared back to Toyota because everyone wanted one. But we've got a GR Sport through the garage this week and I've managed to nab the keys and I'm really, really enjoying it. It's a huge step forward from the last car. It makes it feel prehistoric, actually, in a whole lot of ways. The interior feels great. The GR Sport's got this really clever active anti-roll system and adaptive suspension, and you can really feel the difference as you flick from comfort to normal to sport mode. And this new engine, which we were a little bit worried about, as it turns out, there was nothing to worry about because in my driving so far, it just feels torquey and smooth and really responsive. And little things, like when you want to go up a driveway slowly, it doesn't feel boosty or laggy or anything like that. It feels like you can get exactly the right amount out of it, which is very handy for off-roading as well. So, yeah, I wasn't sure what to expect going in, but I've come away very impressed so far.
Why were we worried about the engine?
The last Land Cruiser had a V8 and people really liked it. It was a really durable engine, although it was quite thirsty. The new car's got a V6 that is smaller displacement and obviously down two cylinders. And just, I mean, change is scary when it comes to a car like the Land Cruiser because it's known for just being this thing that will work no matter where you go and what you do with it. But based on first impressions, and it's not going to be for 5 or 6 years, we know whether this twin turbo V6 engine can stand up in the same way the V8 can. But based on the way it performs, it represents a pretty big step forward.
Cool. Are you planning to take it off-road?
So I know Paul is going to off-road it tomorrow when they film it out at the Werribee four-wheel drive centre. I'm also heading away with it on the weekend, so there'll be a bit of a highway trip and then hopefully some pretty mild trails, but enough just to see how it goes.
Awesome. Have you had a chance to drive one yet, Moko?
Yeah, briefly. I wouldn't profess to have really scratched below the surface all that much, so I've obviously been following the project very closely. I love the fact that this is the most Australian Land Cruiser ever in terms of its development work that was done here. And you're right, Scott, it's a huge step forward. I don't think Toyota's going to have a huge issue convincing existing owners to upgrade. Toyota's earned the right to be trusted when it comes to this, although it has had a few recent hiccups around the 2.8 and the Hilux. So there'll definitely be perhaps a few little nerves there, but overall, a super impressive thing. Looks the part. Is going to absolutely kill it on the sales charts because right now that supply situation isn't getting, you know, particularly better anytime soon and demand is super high. So, yeah, interesting one to watch.
Yeah, well, we're going to touch on that whole supply shortage coming up with VFACTS very soon, but that'll be after the news. And we will kick off the news with you, Scully. The 2023 Volkswagen Amarok reveal has been set, and we know when it's coming to Australia.
We sure do. So having seen the Ford Ranger 2 weeks ago now, the next natural question was, when are we going to see the Amarok? Because we know those two cars have been developed side by side. We were at a big Volkswagen event this week, and one of the things they talked about, there's more news to come after this podcast goes live, but was the next-gen Amarok. And we've got a first look at some fresh sketches of the car. They've got like a South African look about them because unlike the current car, which is built in Argentina, the Amarok that's coming in 2023 to Australia will be South African made. But we also learned that, yeah, it'll be revealed mid-next year. It'll go on sale late in 2022 for Europe, and we can expect to see it in Australia early in 2023, which puts it just over 6 months behind the Ranger. More about the Amarok is kind of hard to come by. We know that Ford is doing a V6 in the Ranger, and we know Volkswagen will do the same with the Amarok because Australia is the world's biggest market for that V6 Amarok, and 90% of sales of that car here do have the bigger, more powerful engine. So Volkswagen wasn't going to give that up, and it wouldn't surprise me if they were one of the reasons that Ford finally committed to doing it in the Ranger.
Just to clarify, Scully, just because I've been wondering this, the Amarok won't – it's not going to get – the Volkswagen 3-litre V6, right? Did we get the Ford Powerstroke V6 from the Ranger?
We don't know. Right. I would be surprised if they didn't share an engine, given how much of everything else they share. But I did like threaten harm to all sorts of Volkswagen people yesterday, and none of them would tell me. So at this stage, we don't know. Volkswagen did spend quite a lot of time talking about how Volkswagen this car is, how they've gone the harder route, how they've tried to give it Volkswagen DNA and character. And I mean, on the one hand, that could just mean that it looks like a Volkswagen and inside it's got a Volkswagen steering wheel and seats and touch points and that sort of thing. But the amount they were talking about it gives me at least some sort of hope or sense that maybe it will have a Volkswagen Group engine. But at this point, we just don't know.
Do we also know if it's going to get second row airbags?
It definitely should. That's been one of the big criticisms of the current Amarok. It's now a really old car, and when it launched, that wasn't really an expectation. These were tradie cars or cars for off-road enthusiasts, but over the past 12 years, those expectations have changed, and all of a sudden, these are now family cars as well. So given the Ranger is going to have a full suite of safety equipment and airbags, it'd be a very, very strange decision for Volkswagen to not do the same.
All right. Now, this is interesting. Haval H9 has been discontinued, Moco. Why is this?
The mighty Haval H9. Yeah, one of the first Chinese cars I ever drove, actually. And surprisingly good off-road. It's Haval's, you know, Prado-sized luxury off-roader that's sold for a medium SUV price. Pretty good off-road, pretty tough, always under-engined, but kind of likable. But it's also as old as the hills. And the last few global updates we saw, I say global, but I mean for China and Russia, the last few updates we saw didn't materialize in Australia. And finally, it's reached an end of production, particularly in right-hand drive. That being said, Haval has got about 100 million cars coming. So this year, it's raced up the sales charts into the top 15 brands. It sold more than 16,000 cars just out of nowhere alongside its GWM sister brand. And it's promised that some form of hardcore big SUV will replace it, whether that's the Tank 300 or the Tank 500 or the Haval Big Dog. There's all sorts of funny cars out there. There's a story that we've run in the last few days on the site doing a bit of a detailed kind of look at all the different electric products and SUV products and 4x4 products that Great Wall Motor with its Haval brand wants to bring. So go check that out, and they've got some great names. They actually look the part too. So I've no doubt that the H9 will be replaced, but for the time being, that company's going to have to go without its enduring body-on-frame 4x4.
It's interesting they're not getting the next H9 or the updated H9 in Australia because global markets have had a facelifted version of that car for quite a while. So if Great Wall could keep selling it, I'm sure it would. It does kind of suggest that they've got something pretty good lined up, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, they've got the new GWM Ute is doing pretty well. It's a big improvement on the shocking old Steed. There'll be some sort of body-on-frame 4x4 of that type made for global markets that might fall under that Tank brand, which is its own standalone brand now with a lot of, you know, big 4x4 products for China. One of those is going to go right-hand drive. It's a fait accompli. It's just, it has to get in line behind a few other things that Haval's working on as well.
All right, we're going to move to, or we just sort of touched briefly on this with the Volkswagen Amarok story. We've got details and specs for the 2022 Ford Ranger, Scully.
We sure have. This was down to some intrepid sleuthing on the Ford website from, I believe, Marriage and then Will Stop Ford.
Nice.
But Ford has actually given us a layout of what to expect from the Ranger lineup when it launches in the middle of next year. As it turns out, even the base model XL, which still gets steel wheels, still gets halogen daytime running lights, still gets a black grille, you'll get a digital instrument cluster and a 10.1-inch touchscreen that's vertically oriented on the dashboard. That means that even the cheapest Ranger, when it launches in 2022, will have a bigger, better screen than the most expensive Ranger Raptor or Wildtrak in 2021. We're expecting to see a whole range of engines and four-wheel drive systems offered across the range, and that'll be two different versions of a 2.2-litre single-turbo engine, a 2-litre bi-turbo engine, and then the 3-litre V6 we're expecting at the top of the range. That V6 will have a full-time all-wheel drive system like the current Amarok that means that you get the benefit of all-wheel drive on wet roads, and then you can flick into low range or lock differentials when you're going off-road and get even more hardcore coverage. It's not clear which models those will be offered on just yet, though. Moving up to the XLS, and you get a very similar equipment list to what you get at the moment. It's a black grille, halogen lights, and 16-inch alloy wheels finished in the delightfully dainty-sounding dark sparkle silver, and some more interior luxuries. And then the XLT and the Wildtrak take things to the next level again with the full-size display that we're expecting. There's a picture in here of a 12-inch screen in the Wildtrak, which just looks awesome. It's lifted out of the Mustang Mach-E. You can also get things like leather upholstery with what Ford calls cyber orange stitching, a whole lot of aluminium or grey accents, and little things like a little T-bar shifter that takes up less space on the transmission tunnel. So there's nothing particularly surprising about any of it, but it is really interesting that Ford already has details out there about this new Ranger, given we're sort of 6 or 7 months out from it actually arriving down under. It's not surprising, though, to know that Ford is going to make the most of this Ranger because we know it's such a big deal for them, and we know also that dealers are already starting to get orders for them and questions about them. So it's probably a good thing if you're a Ford dealer that you can start telling people what they're going to get.
And lastly, Moko, a little bit of politics news, I suppose. The Labor government outlines electric vehicle strategy and calls for tax incentives.
Yeah, don't stress, listeners. I'm not going to go onto a political diatribe here. We're still car expert. But yeah, so the Federal Opposition Party, the ALP, has lobbed something of an electric vehicle plan. We know the context at the moment is Australia is a bit behind the times when it comes to EV sales, especially compared to Europe or China or the United States. And there are many countries now saying as soon as the 2030s, they're going to outlaw all non-electric or hydrogen new vehicles. And Australia is nowhere near that yet. The states are lining up and opening their own policies up. And the federal government, aside from funding infrastructure, hasn't done a whole lot. So the federal ALP wants to change that. About $250 million over 3 years, it would pledge to commit to this plan after acknowledging that cars are the biggest contributor to household energy costs and emissions. It's called the Federal Coalition's approach toxic scaremongering, quote, and said it's going to remove import tariffs and the fringe benefits tax. So there's currently a 47% tax on EVs that are provided through work for private use. So those two taxes would be removed, particularly on affordable EVs. But there's no talk of a federal incentive of any sort yet, or more importantly, any specific automotive-related CO2 cap. However, the ALP has pledged to sit down with all industry parties and drum up a proper national electric vehicle strategy should it win government. And that's really the big takeaway from this is it will sit down with stakeholders and work out a proper strategy for Australia's approach to electric cars, because whether we like it or not, we're going to have a flood of electric vehicles come to this market, and we need to work out, you know, what the policy framework around it's going to be, particularly with road funding and things like that. So I think what this really is it's a political posturing exercise where The ALP has said, look, we're going to contrast ourselves to the current government and say that we're pro-EV. We've got all these ideas that we're going to bring in, and they're going to try and, you know, make that a bit of a vote getter, which should hopefully force the other side to promise something similar.
It'll be very interesting to see how this issue is politicised going forward. And like Mike, I don't want to go down a political rabbit hole, but last election, there was a lot of talk about electric cars and electric utes trying to steal the weekend, about them not being ready for Australians. And we've seen a real shift in that rhetoric from the Liberal Party. So fingers crossed, this time coming into the election, the conversation about what is undoubtedly a technology that's going to come to Australia at some point is a little bit more intelligent and less politicised and sort of spun off from what we actually know to be true about electric cars.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is at a state level, both Coalition and ALP governments have got some great policies at the moment. So the New South Wales Liberal Party probably has the best policy in the country. In fact, it does have the best policy in the country when it comes to supporting the rollout of EVs. So this is, it's not about saying one party sucks at electric cars and one doesn't. It's more about saying that the more they both have to talk about it, the more new policies that we're going to see generated, and that can only be a good thing.
Absolutely agree. If you would like to read more, it's actually a really fascinating article, the one we just spoke about, head to carexpert.com.au. November's new car sales figures have been released this week, and Moco, it really wasn't a good month last month.
No, it wasn't. So sales fell 15.3% during November. It's the second month in a row sales have dropped, mostly reflective of ongoing stock shortages, which is principally a result of semiconductor supply constraints. So sales across all eight states and territories went backwards, and that's compared to last November in 2020. But then again, it's important to point out that November last year was a massive month. It was the first growth month in some time. The top line findings from the month, Toyota fell almost 35% on the back of very little stock, at least by its standards, but it stayed number one. China's MG, GWM and LDV all continued their surge up the charts. Honda took another massive dive in what, the fourth month since it started its new agency model. Electric cars and plug-in hybrids are both up more than 200%, and business fleet sales tumbled by almost 30%. So they're the top line findings.
So what was the reasoning why the numbers were so low this last month?
Mostly supply. So there's very much not a lack of demand out there at the moment, and that's being reflected in used car prices also being at all-time highs as the economy slowly recovers from, you know, the sort of very interrupted last year and a half. Demand is there. Manufacturers just aren't able to supply it. That's why prices are so high, and it's why there's waiting lists on a number of the nation's favourite cars. And look, 2022 promises to be better on that front, but at the moment, definitely a supply-side issue.
Moco, are the car makers you've been talking to predicting that there will be a month where it springs back, or a point where we'll flick a switch and production will reach normal levels, or is this just going to be ongoing for the next 6-12 months?
Really depends on the brands, to be honest. Different brands have different agreements with chip suppliers. So, you know, there's sort of three or four really big chip suppliers out there. They have existing priority arrangements with certain manufacturers. There's obviously politicking going on as well. Car brands with more purchasing power probably get earlier access, which is why some of the minnow brands might struggle for a bit longer. So it goes from brand to brand. There are some that are predicting they're already going to recover pretty much right away, like Toyota. There are others saying 2023 at the earliest. So it really does depend.
Wow. All right, so we probably should get into the thick of it, of the top models and the brands.
Yeah, so Toyota number one, despite being down 34%, Hyundai into second because it was only down 0.7%. So in the grand scheme, that was a pretty good result. Ford in third on the back of a massive month from Ranger and Everest. Mitsubishi in fourth, surging, particularly on the back of rental car recovery. We're seeing that market really recover. Mazda slid to fifth, although it's still second year to date. Kia in sixth. MG up into seventh position, up 85%. So continuing to buck the trend with cheap, well-warrantied cars, particularly in the electric car space, and lots of supply. Nissan in eighth, Volkswagen and Subaru rounding out the 10. GWM in 14th place and LDV in 15th place. So as mentioned before, those Chinese brands doing really well. And the other one people love to talk about is poor old Honda, continues to battle, down 46%, right down there, 18th position, so just working into the top 20, not the sort of volume we're used to seeing from that brand.
Eek. So was it Hilux or Ranger that came on top this last month?
Yeah, I love how you don't even have to ask. It's going to be one of the two, isn't it? So, yes, it was Ranger. Hasn't been able to close the gap year to date yet. Probably won't, despite, you know, a fast finish. But Ranger 1 for the month, Hilux 2, Hyundai i33. Not a whole lot of surprises there. MG ZS 9th. I love the Land Cruiser 70 alone was inside the top 20. That was 15th. Just that's not including the 300. So a pretty remarkable result there. Ford Everest, first time I think that's ever finished in the top 20, had a massive month. Diesel 4x4s continuing to surge, but no great surprises really.
It's amazing what happens when you sell a car with no semiconductors like the Land Cruiser 70. It makes it far easier to source. Do we have any update from Toyota on when the Land Cruiser 300 will start rolling out in earnest? I know they delivered their first car to customers this month, but presumably supply for that's still tight.
It's funny you say that. You'd think the 70 series supply would be good, but they've got 9-month wait lists on them. So I don't know what's happening there. I don't think they can make too many of them. They're so old school. But as far as the 300's concerned, as you say, deliveries are beginning this month. But, you know, we're not going to see significant numbers coming through until the first quarter of 2022. And a lot of the initial batch will already be spoken for. So there's going to be some kinks in that supply chain for a while yet, although you'd expect it to level out as the year progresses.
I noticed in the comments section some people were asking about how some of the French brands went. Did you want to give a bit of a summary on that as well?
So Renault had a pretty strong month, just over 1,000 sales, pretty much neck and neck with what it did last year. And it actually, looking at the list here, was ahead of Jeep and ahead of Lexus and ahead of Skoda. So that's a pretty good month for Renault. Citroën, honestly, you sort of have to wonder sometimes why Citroën bothers. It was up 23%, which is good, but it was still only 32 sales for the month, which is nothing flash. Peugeot, 261, up 40%. So we're starting to see the French brands do okay, although I do wonder why Citroën bothers, to be quite honest with you.
So what can we expect for next month's sales in the lead up to Christmas?
Yeah, look, I mean, supply is going to continue to be an issue. We're going to squeak over the million mark for the year, which is obviously last year was the first time in a long time that didn't happen. And it's at 972,000 year to date. So when you step back far enough in the grand scheme, it's going to be a relatively okay year. It won't go down in the annals as some massive failure of a year. I think you'll see a lot of car brands starting to run out of stock as the year goes on. And you probably won't see, you know, any sort of bumper result for December. I think there might be a bit of a surge in Ford Ranger sales, though, because I know they've got some pretty good supply at the moment, and there's a very tiny chance they might be able to, you know, bump the Hilux. So I reckon that might happen. Yeah. Other than that, your guess is as good as mine.
We've covered off everything, haven't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. All right. Well, that full VFAX report can be found at carexpert.com.au. I'll take a line from Tony Crawford's recent review. I can tell you categorically the new 911 GT3 is the most complete naturally aspirated Porsche GT road car I've ever driven. Do we really need to say any more, Crawf? Hello.
Not really.
That ends this week's review.
It's as good as done. If you've got the money, go and buy one, if you can get one.
So that is my favourite review of yours I've ever heard, Crawford. Two sentences, it was perfect. It says it all. I also love, Mandy, that when you were doing your little Crawford impersonation then, you couldn't help but exaggerate the hand gestures that go with it.
I didn't realise I was doing that.
It's so subconscious. I do it too. You can't help it.
I know. So, Crawford, you said, you know, if it's worth the money and if you can get your hands on it, does that mean a lot of people have already put their names down for it?
They have. In fact, I'm actually selling my 991 at the moment.
Wow.
To gear up for a potential, but I'm told by Chris Jordan of Porsche Australia that good luck. That's basically what he said to me.
Yeah. Crawf, I remember you telling me that you never, ever planned to sell that 911 you've got, so the GT3 must be pretty special to make you finally part ways with it.
Yeah, it's in another league, Scott. It's just wherever you look, wherever you sit in the car, it's, you know, from the colour. I literally fell in love with that shark blue, and much to my horror, it's about a $7,500 option But I'd have to have it. I couldn't buy that 911 GT3 without that shark blue with black wheels. It's just the most special looking thing. And, you know, this is all very odd to me, but those of you that bothered to read the review or may go and read the review on carexpert.com.au will find that I actually didn't like this car when I first saw the pics on our website. I thought they've probably gone a step too far with Porsche's 911 Evolution. It just looks so very different from the 991.2. And but, you know, as Porsche seems to do, their designs seem to gel with you the more you see them. And it's no different with this one. And, yeah, I'm just – I couldn't imagine myself. My car looks prehistoric now. And, I mean, it's a nice little classic daily, to be honest, for someone with a bit of cash.
Because you reckon you could daily a GT3?
Oh, no, I'm talking about mine.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, that's how far ahead they've jumped from. I mean, 991 came out in 2012. It's ancient now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's literally, it's 8 years, it's 8-9 years ago. It's really primitive. The 992 was quite a good evolution because it sort of put you into the picture of what to expect of 992. And then this thing comes along and just destroys. You know, I thought the big swan neck wing was going to be crazy. It looked, you know, really silly. It looked almost it was going like a GT3 RS. And when I saw it in person, I was pleasantly surprised because it's actually very low profile and not overly big, but it's extremely effective because in its standard setup, it's 50% more downforce provided than the old GT3 991.2. And if you put it in its track setting, it's 150%, provides 150% more downforce. And you can feel that from the very first time you explode onto the track and turn into a corner. You know, the wheels, they're now 21s on the rear and 20s on the front, staggered racing setup. I never drove the GT3 991.2, but I did manage to track test a 991 GT3 at Queensland Raceway on a Level 4 Master Porsche class. And I always felt that car was slightly like coming into a corner fast. I felt like, gee, I better be careful here because the rear might slip out here. I can almost feel like something's not quite right there. I don't think that's true. I think I just didn't have enough balls to push it, to be honest. But this one, it gives you balls. Can I say that? It tells you, it communicates to you that it's okay. You've got 315s on the back and they're new generation Pilot Sport Cup 2s from Michelin. You're okay. You can be safe. Like, push it. 240 into turn one, no problem. just have some balls, get your eyes up and drive it out. That's what Dave Russell, the V8 supercar driver, kept telling me on the radio. Just drive it out, Tony. That's it. Drive it out. Keep going. And I love that, and we'll talk about that in a minute too. But, Scott, yeah, go for it.
Oh, mate, just wondering about the engine. I saw your video on Facebook, and it sounds like a proper GT3 cup car coming past. How has Porsche managed to make the car more powerful and make an incredible noise, even though emissions regulations and noise regulations are getting tougher?
Funny you should say that, but that engine, that 4-litre naturally aspirated engine, is in fact unchanged from the Porsche Cup Racer. Current Porsche Cup Racer. It's also the same engine that you find in the very expensive 911 Speedster with individual throttle bodies. So that's apparently like having a throttle for each cylinder. And that's why when you just tap the throttle, there's just instantaneous response, which is why you can drive this thing so fast in corners, because you can change your angle of attack, your speed mid corner, and without upsetting the balance of the car. That's why this car is so addictive and intoxicating, and you just want to sell your house. You'll live under a bridge if you can have a GT3.
Would your wife allow you to buy one, though, Croft? That's the big question, though, right?
Mandy, I don't think she'd like to live under a bridge. No, not in a cardboard box. We're not there yet. That might be the case in 20 years. Who knows? But who knows where I'll end up.
So you mentioned the, what was it, $5,000 optional paint. Seven. What other options would you tick in the GT3?
Okay, so the car that we drove on track had the optional carbon buckets. And honestly, you got to have these seats. Like, they're crazy priced at $11,200. But they are literally, you know, they come with a driver's 6-point harness. You don't need to use that at Eastern Creek. Eastern Creek's a very fast track for those that haven't been there. You're doing about 240. Well, actually, let me go back. I was doing 240. Luke Yulden was doing about 260 when he took me for a hot lap at the end, because I thought I could do better on turn one, so I asked Luke to take me for a lap. That guy can drive, let me tell you. And so that's what this car can do straight out of the box. Luke did a 137. He tells me that that's what the Super V8 supercars are doing around there. So this is a road car straight out of the box, and it's competing with the same times of a current V8 supercar. That's pretty amazing to even hear that. It blows my mind, to be honest, you know. And, you know, what it did around the Nürburgring, let's not forget, 17.5 seconds faster than the old one, faster than the GT3 RS around the Nürburgring. So you're talking, everything has been covered off here. Engine, the power of that engine. Yes, Scott, it's only 5 kilowatts up and 10 newton meters up. But, you know, that shows you that the ridiculousness of chasing this 0 to 100 with cars that are doing 2.5 and that, it's just not important if you're going to enjoy the driving experience in a sports car. It's just not. I would say you could have more fun in a Mazda MX-5 than something that does 2.5, you know, because it's just not usable for the everyday guy that can get on track. But if you're behind the wheel of a new GT3, and you haven't done a lot of track experience, you'll end up being pretty fast by the end of the day. And it's mostly Andreas Prittinger and his crack team of Porsche engineers that have done this magic sorcery into this car. And unfortunately, it's priced at 370 grand plus on road. So it's out of the realms of 99% of us, mere mortals. And that's a real shame, because I would love every enthusiast in Australia to have a go of this car, because they will see why Porsche and why the 911 is so revered. And
aside from the price, as you just mentioned, when you said unfortunately, was there anything else that you didn't quite like about it?
The only thing I don't like about it is this stubby little starter thing on the right-hand side. It's not a key and it's not a stub. I don't quite know what it is. It's a piece of plastic that juts out that you turn. And in the old car, you just put the key fob into it, which was shaped like a 911, by the way, the actual key fob with a Porsche crest on it, and you put it into the slot and that, you know, you turned it as you would a key, and that's all gone, unfortunately, with the whole new shifter and all that, the tiny little stubby shifter. It's all gone, and you turn this little stubby thing. I'd get rid of that. I'd go back to a key, you know, like I'm all for keys. And, you know, you're probably not going to daily a 911 GT3. So it's not something you need to take to Woolies or Coles, you know. So you're going to have something else for that, right?
Croft, the other question I always have about the GT3, and I ask this having actually seen a touring and a normal GT3 on a truck on my way to work this morning. They were being transported to a Porsche centre. Would you go for the one with the swan neck wing, or would you make the correct decision and go for a touring instead?
I'd go for both.
I like the idea.
I'd probably daily the touring, but no, if I'm very committed, if I ever get into a GT3 of my own, I'm going to track that.
Well, you'll have to let us know when you sell your 911 and when you buy your new GT3. Because
if anyone has money, and I know Mr. Scully is quite well endowed in that regard, it's on collecting cars. And please, Scott, have a look. You might pick up a bargain.
Croft, can I actually, we've talked about my car on the podcast, I'll swap you my 05 Pajero, which I'm also looking to move, for your 911, and I'll take care of selling that. You don't want tyre kickers and that sort of thing. I'll deal with it for you if you want.
Can I just say collecting cars probably wouldn't be interested in that one?
I can understand
that. Yeah.
All right, Croft, that review is live now, so thank you so much.
Thanks very much, guys.
Michael, let's talk about a ute you've reviewed this week, the Nissan Navara Pro 4X Warrior. Is it the world's toughest Navara?
I'm sure that there are a couple of people who visited Ironman or ARB or TJM who swear they've got a tougher Navara, and who am I to question them? This is certainly the toughest Navara that you can buy in a dealership. That's for damn sure. And what's really interesting about it is it's been created in partnership with a Melbourne engineering firm, best known for its work with Ford, called Premcar. There's an assembly line in the northern suburbs of Melbourne that basically puts Navaras through a process and turns them into Warriors for about a $9,000 markup over the Pro 4X grade on which it's based. And, you know, this is not just some simple sticker pack like we sometimes see with special edition utes. When it says it's the world's toughest Navara, it really is. And as you say, we drove it recently. Nissan was kind enough to stage a national launch up in the hills around the Coffs Harbour region, which made good testing grounds indeed.
Yeah. So how much money are we talking for this model?
Yeah, so it is a pretty pricey thing. So $69,990 plus on-road costs for the auto, $2,500 less for the manual that nobody will buy. That's not a small or inconsequential amount of money. That's nudging the same sort of territory as a Hilux Rugged X, or it's about, what, $10,000 off the top-of-the-range Walkinshaw Amarok, similar money to a Ranger FX4 Max and Mazda BT50 Thunder as well. So some pretty stiff competition there, especially when you consider that the Navara has always been more of a value proposition.
Mm. Has it got the same engine as before?
No changes to the engine, which is one of the weak points of this car. The 2.3-litre twin-turbo diesel with the 7-speed auto is good in some ways. It's very refined. It's pretty good on juice, 8.1 litres every 100 k's. Very, very quiet. Not the gruntiest thing. 140 kilowatt, 450 newton metres. Doesn't push you back in your chair like an Amarok V6. And with that Ranger soon picking up a V6, there's every chance that the engine might look a little bit underdone. But, you know, commercial realities obviously stopped Premcar from chipping it or putting an exhaust on it or anything of that nature.
Yeah, cool. How does it compare both on and off-road?
Yeah, so basically it takes the Pro 4X, which is the top-of-the-range Navara in terms of looks. So it's got the big sports bar and the stickers and sort of that tough truck look. And it adds some really, really good features. So it's got a winch-compatible Nissan Genuine Steel Hoopless Bull Bar, so a big, solid, tough steel bull bar that improves your approach angle. So you can really drop it into ruts and not worry about tearing off the OE front bumper. There's a Warrior specific tow bar, a horizontal light bar, a branded red bash plate and 3mm of underbody plating. Nice big 275/70 Cooper Discoverer all-terrain tires, flares, because obviously that track has grown and you've got to cover it to meet 80 hours. Some new springs and dampers, so a 40mm lift overall, 260mm clearance, and some new, you know, little tweaks on the inside to the upholstery and things like that. So as I said before, it's not just a sticker pack. There's been some work put into it. And in terms of the way it goes on road, it builds on what the old M-Trek Warrior was able to do. So Australia has some really challenging terrain that it's great to test 4x4s on, particularly long corrugated stretches of road that are really damaging to the ride. This car floated beautifully over those, plenty of extra sidewall on the tyres and travel in the springs. And What's good about it is it's not just an ad hoc sticking bits on a car. It's all being tuned cohesively as a single piece over tens of thousands of kilometres, which is the advantage of using a firm of such expertise. We did some pretty challenging off-road and got to the point where, you know, those tyres were so full of clay that they essentially had no grip left on them. Nevertheless, it got through everything fine. It's got a part-time 4x4 system, the same as the regular cars. So obviously low range, as well as a closed center diff, high range 4x4 with a rear diff lock. I'd love to see some sort of on-road, on-demand all-wheel drive mode, but again, commercial realities have stopped that from happening. But it got through everything we threw at it, and we threw plenty at it. I think ultimately there are plenty of real devotees that would prefer to buy their Navara if they're a Navara fan and drive to ARB or any one of the other myriad number of aftermarket providers and do their own tune. But for those that want an out-of-the-box solution that is just ready to roll, it's pretty impressive. And, you know, I've got to commend Nissan and Premcar for going the extra mile on doing it.
There's quite a few of these tougher trucks now available, and a lot of them have a lot of Australian input. There's the Walkinshaw W580 Amarok, the Toyota Rugged and Rogue. How does Premcar differ from the organizations behind those ones? And what did it do before it was making Navaras? Because they're quite a cool story.
Yeah. So in essence, the program isn't all that different. A mixture of Nissan genuine parts as well as its own, you know, bespoke bits are used. In terms of the way it's developed and where it's developed, there's a wide range of surfaces and test facilities that are used, but they're not particularly unique because Toyota uses similar ones and in fact, some of the same ones for its programs. And, you know, there's such a good, you know, local engineering scene, particularly in Victoria. I wouldn't say that Walkinshaw or Premcar are better or worse than one another. They're both bloody good at what they do. So, you know, I wouldn't say they're particularly different. In terms of scale, it's not at the same scale as Toyota's setup because Toyota sells a lot more Hiluxes than Nissan sells Navaras. And as you say, Premcar's story is super interesting. They did the Holy Grail pack on the Falcon, a lot of FPV projects over the years. A lot of other things too that they've done, but I guess the Ford one is probably the one that really sticks in people's minds. I know, Scully, you've had a bit to do with them as well over the years.
Yeah, they're a very interesting firm, and the people we've spoken to there, I know Bernie Quinn has been heavily involved. He heads up Premcar, and he's a really interesting guy with a really interesting motoring history. It's amazing how bespoke this project is to the Navara. Premcar has essentially expanded its operations and its production line just to build more of these Navaras, and Nissan has had a really positive response from head office on the back of it as well. So fingers crossed going forward they can expand the partnership further, and when the new Navara arrives, apply the same sort of treatment, because there's a lot to be said for cars that are driven on Australian roads in Australian conditions being tuned by people and teams that have a lot of experience on that front.
And let's hope that bloody patrol warrior arrives at some point before 2026. Come on, Nissan.
God, it feels like it's so far away.
I want to do a GR Sport and Patrol Warrior comparison, please. Let's make that happen.
Yes. Have you given it a car expert rating yet, Moko?
Yeah, I gave it an 8 out of 10. So that's, you know, classic, 8 out of 10, the classic exciting result. But the reality is that the regular Navara is a sort of mid-sevens car, and this is the best of the bunch as far as Navaras go. So that sort of feels about right to me.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to jump out of a ute and into a supercar, the Maserati MC20. I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful Maserati. It's absolutely gorgeous. Can you give us a bit of a summary of the MC20?
Yeah, really glad that I had the front suspension lifter fitted, activated by a button on the steering wheel, because you know, you've got those carbon fiber front splitters and lots of steep driveways, and there's very few things more terrifying than that combination. Not to mention the fact that the day that Maserati threw me the keys, there was a bloody hailstorm in Melbourne. So I had to very carefully plot and plan when I was going to drive it and when I was going to have it safely undercover, because I didn't want it to look like a golf ball when I gave it back. That might be a bit of trouble. Look, The MC20 really, it's not really about the MC20 in a sense. What it really is about Maserati's return to form. Maserati has promised so many times that it's back, and it's made so many promises that it's going to hark back to its glory. But this is a 107-year-old company with so much history, and everybody desperately wants it to win. And this car, which stands for Maserati Corsa 2020, is a mid-engined carbon fiber supercar, no compromises, a mostly in-house V6 engine, and a bead drawn firmly on the prancing horse in Maranello. It's even got those incredible butterfly doors that open up in the most dramatic of fashions. So a proper supercar, but it also gives hints and indications about what Maserati as a whole is plotting and planning. It's got its new Grecale crossover coming that it will allegedly use a version of this engine in the top line guises, and shows the world that Maserati still knows how to engine a pretty goddamn amazing car.
Cool. I suppose the price really doesn't matter when you're talking about these sort of cars, but how does it compare to its competitors?
So there's the price of a supercar, and then there's the price of a supercar because, you know, no one's buying it off the shelf, are they? So it's 438 grand before on roads, which it's about 50 grand less than a Ferrari F8 Tributo and very similar money to a McLaren Artura. So there or thereabouts. You might say, hang on, Maserati shouldn't be playing in the same sandpit as McLaren and Ferrari. And I guess this car is about saying that actually, no, Maserati does deserve to be in that same echelon. But our car was actually $640,000 because wow. It had a lot of things added onto it. Lashings of carbon fiber in particular added a lot of the costs, but there was also a ton of other things on there, including that aforementioned front lifter. And you'd be amazed some of the things that are optioned, like blind spot monitoring is an option. And really? Given that you can't really see out of it because it's a mid-engined car, I think that probably ought to be standard. But as you sort of said, price is kind of irrelevant on a car like this.
Moco, I think Maserati and I think noise, because all of the current Maserati cars, although they might not be the newest or the most dynamically incredible things based on what I've read anyway, the Gran Turismo and the Gran Sport still have this stunning V8 engine that's like a Ferrari with all the exhaust baffles taken out. How does the turbo engine in the MC20 stack up?
Yeah, it's the perfect question. And, you know, Maserati, as much as things like Gran Turismo and Quattroporte are flawed cars, when you just hear one, you know, with the taps open, all is sort of forgiven. This is not a Ferrari engine vehicle. There are aspects that are sort of shared, I believe, but Maserati talks about this being a Maserati engine. It's got a carbon fiber cover and it certainly looks amazing, and it's hidden below a clear, you know, mid-engined lift door. So in terms of the theater, like every other supercar, amazing. In terms of its performance, it's only a 3 liter, but 470 kilowatts and 730 newton meters and a sub 3 second 0 to 100 time. Got all that. In terms of the way it sounds, I love personally the sound of a crisp six. Some of my favorite cars ever made have been sixes. They've definitely got their own note. If you're the sort of person who loved the deep, growly, angry Maserati V8 rumble, it doesn't have that, and you're probably not going to dig it. There were people playing around with it at the garage just listening to it, and it was a polarizing thing. Some people loved the way it sounded and some didn't. I can't fault the performance, but there are those that won't love the sound.
Mm. Did it sound okay, though, in the cabin, because seeing it's a mid-engine right behind your head?
Yeah, it does, and especially in full-on Corsa mode where you put it in its angriest setting, it does. It's right behind your head. The company, there's intakes right behind you as well, so it is a really theatrical experience. And it's just got that typical sort of high, raspy noise that great sixes do. It loves a rev. The gearbox is really, really well suited to it. What surprised me is not just, you know, again, I didn't drive it on a racetrack, so I'm not going to pretend that I stretched its dynamic boundaries, but the fact that it was so livable and docile as a daily in its normal mode and then so capable of just pinning you into the seat every chance you get shows that it's got a real kind of breadth of abilities to it, which was quite impressive.
Fantastic. What's the interior like?
The interior is polarized, actually, very minimalist. So a lot of Alcantara and carbon fiber touch points, very, very, very simple. Not a lot going on, not a lot to distract you. It's got a touch screen that sort of tilts downwards oddly, and the pedal is slightly misaligned. So you've got those classic Italian quirks that just carry over like they always do. But I I like the fact that it's extremely driver focused. It's just you, the fixed aluminium paddles, a big digital display, a tiny screen, and a very thin center tunnel covered in carbon fiber with a couple of buttons on it to control your driving modes. And that dial feels like a Swiss watch, and then a few other buttons for your gear shifters. So there's no actual physical gear shifter like normal. You know, great bucket seats. It's even got front and rear boots, although the total boot capacity for both is just over 200 litres, so pretty useless. Some people have said it needs more bling. I actually kind of liked it, and I'm quite big as well. I'm not quite as tall as Scully, but I am certainly taller than the average person and was able to get really comfy, plenty of seat adjustment, plenty of wheel adjustment, not a lot of visibility out, but very livable as far as supercars go.
When it comes to the way that it looks, these cars, although they're about going quickly and, you know, dynamic excellence, they're also about being parked in front of a nightclub on Chapel Street. Do you think that it has the appeal to make people think about Maserati differently to how they do at the moment? Because I personally was blown away by it up close, but you may have a different opinion.
Yeah, I mean, based on the number of neck-snapping people, you know, gawking at me as I drove past them. And also, you know, was stuck in Punt Road traffic. So, you know, plenty of long lingering glances were possible for people. It looks amazing. It just does. You cannot argue that yellow paint with this beautiful underlying sort of bluey pearlescent tinge to it is, I don't know, I didn't think I'd like it in the flesh, but I did. The silhouette of this car is something else. I think it's one of the sexiest cars that I've seen in a long time, frankly. And, you know, sometimes you see, you know, pipe dream companies launch supercar concepts that look amazing, and Maserati's gone ahead and actually built one. And it could easily be a show concept car, and yet it's on the road. And, you know, that alone makes the price of entry worth it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like Maserati is back. As you said earlier, Moco, is it back? I think it is.
Yeah, it's just good to see Maserati in the same conversation as the Astons, the McLarens, the Ferraris, the Lambos of the world. That's where Maserati belongs. It doesn't belong down there, you know, fighting with BMW and Audi for sales. It belongs further up, I think, and that's exactly what this car does.
Absolutely. Both those reviews are at the site now if you want to go check them out. There goes another Car Expert podcast. Where's the team off to next week, Moco?
Couple of end of year events going on. I'm off to see our friends at GM Specialty Vehicles for an end of year event showcasing the Corvette, C8 Corvette, and the all new Silverado HD. So getting a taste of some Americana. And Scully, you're going to go drive the end of the line GTR, Nissan GTR.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. I got my email from Nissan yesterday saying, if you can rock up at this time, you'll arrive. We'll talk to you about the car. And then you've got half an hour with an instructor in the passenger seat around Sandown. So there are very few tough days doing this job. It's a really fun job. But there are some days that are even less tough than others. And that's one of them, I think.
So what cars are in the garage next week, Scully?
So we've got a bit of a mix coming into Christmas. There's a lot of stuff that's just launching or just being wrapped up. We've got the Jaguar E-Pace P250 R Dynamic S, whoever named that was paid by the letter. The Nissan Navara Pro 4 X Warrior for a video from Paul. A Land Cruiser 300 Sahara ZX, which is meant to be the more luxurious top-end Land Cruiser. And then the MY22 Isuzu D-Max X Terrain. We've also got the BMW X3 xDrive 30e, which is the plug-in hybrid X3 with the facelifted face. Going to be really interested to see how that stacks up. And then up in Sydney, we've got everything from a Jaguar F-Type P450 to a Kia Cerato S. So a fair bit of variety going on, everything from entry-level sedans all the way up to top-of-the-range Jaguars with a V8.
Absolutely love it. Never a dull day at Car Expert. Mike Costello and Scott Colley, thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.